It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The first of its kind, a modern election in Pennsylvania during a pandemic, is over. Well, sort of. On the line is Chris Potter, WESA's government and accountability editor. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Kevin.
We'll get to that sort of over in a minute or two. Chris, sure. A peaceful election day overall. One incident, a constable wrangling with a voter at a polling place at Alderdice High School in Squirrel Hill. Otherwise, mostly a calm day, it seems like.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there were scattered issues, but there always are. You know, there used to be problems with touchscreen voting machines. So actually, I think we all sort of were a little anxious about what was going to happen here. I know county officials were, but things went fairly smoothly yesterday. The one other sort of issue was the polling place in Penn Hills, the Penn Hills Library, had to be kept open for an additional hour. Because there were issues. People were having a really hard time getting to the polling place because the parking lot's small and there wasn't any available parking nearby. And so lawyers had to go and ask a judge to keep the polling place there open for another hour, and he did so. But when you think about it, it's sort of amazing that in the middle of a pandemic, in the middle of these protests, with everything going on, all this new approach to mail-in ballots and everything, that things went as smoothly as they did.
Well, let's talk about the mail-in ballots. Normally, at this time, the day after, you and I would be talking about definite results, 98% of precincts reporting, and this candidate has defeated this one. The county says it scanned all 207,000 mail-in ballots it received, but there are another 73,000 that were requested out there. So what could this mean overall?
Yeah, so one of the things we don't know is how many of those ballots are yet to come in. Late Monday, Governor Wolf said that in Allegheny and five other counties in the state, that elections officials would have to count ballots if they were postmarked yesterday, but could come into the office as late as Tuesday. And he did that because of the disruptions with the protests and the coronavirus. So what we don't know at this point of those 70,000 plus votes is how many of them may come in. How many of them won't come in at all because people just said, to heck with it, I'm not going to vote. That happens every year, too, with absentee ballots or whatever. So there's a big kind of unknown hanging over this, which is how many of those ballots have yet to come in. And the county still today has to finish tabulating the votes from the in-person voting that happened yesterday. That work has not been done. It has processed all the mail-in ballots that it had. But now they've got to get through the ones that we voted with yesterday. And, you know, I know it's frustrating for people. It's frustrating for me. But this is the thing. When we went away from the electronic touchscreen machines, the one thing those things were was fast. And it takes longer to scan a ballot than it does to download a file off of a hard drive on a voting machine. So it's just going to take some time.
Okay. Well, let's talk about some things we know, or at least we think we know. Yesterday, we talked about Summer Lee's bid for a second term. Did she defeat? Is it safe to say that she defeated Democratic challenger Chris Rowland?
I am willing to put a lot of money on Summer Lee having defeated Chris Rowland. She is up by more than 3-1 over him, 3.5-1 practically. Just a huge, huge night for her. She out fundraised them. This is just a butt kicking. Okay. I think we'll be seeing her in Harrisburg next year.
Okay. And another state house race we talked about briefly yesterday was incumbent Adam Ravenstahl in the 20th district house race against Emily Kincaid. Do we know anything there yet?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a race that's right on the bubble for me. Emily Kincaid has been up in that race, was up in that race last night. She's got a lead of, I think, about 1,000 votes over him. It looks good for her having toppled Adam Ravenstahl, and that is a big result last night. Not definitive, as you say, but it's looking very promising for her.
All right, we have just about a minute left. Anything from that 36th House district? I think it's the Harry Reid Shaw district, who's retired, and there were multiple candidates there wanting to get the Democratic nomination.
Yeah, four candidates right now. Jessica Benham, running as the most progressive candidate in the race, is in the lead. Interestingly, I think for some people, Heather Cass, who is the endorsed Democrat, who's sort of been a lightning rod for controversy, is in third place right now. And the second place candidate, I think I mentioned him yesterday, is kind of my sleeper candidate here, is Ed Mueller, who is in second place. Benham has been up by about 4 percentage points. We'll see if that holds. That's one I'm not willing to call, but I guess I'd rather be Benham than anybody else in it at this point.
All right, Chris. So what does this, how the whole process went, portend for November? Can we say yet in a couple of sentences, do you think people like this mail-in ballot thing?
I think people do. I mean, the chair of the Republican Party in Allegheny County said that he was pleased with the way mail-in balloting had gone. There had been concerns about in-person voting. Some precincts didn't had a little trouble getting their hands on the Republican ballots for Republican voters. I think this could have been much, much, much worse.
Okay.
I think there are some things that need to be done better.
All right. We will leave it there. Chris Potter is WESA's government and accountability editor. Thanks so much, Chris.
Thank you, Kevin. Have a good one.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The emergency declaration has been lifted by the state Supreme Court, and this week, courts in Allegheny County reopened, but with some precautions due to the pandemic. To prevent crowded hallways, cases are staggered, and there are floor markings for the parties to keep their distance in the courtrooms. There are some legal implications to the remaining restrictions, so we've called on WESA's legal analyst, University of Pittsburgh Law Professor David Harris. David, there'll be no jury trials in criminal or civil court for now. No jury trials. Is that concerning?
Yes, it is, Kevin. For civil cases, it simply means there'll be a wait. But for criminal cases, it really is a concern. There is a right that criminal defendants have in both the federal constitution and the state constitution to a trial by jury. And not having a jury trial in certain kinds of cases could disadvantage a defendant. And so the block on jury trials for now is a real concern.
So if you go ahead with a trial with the judge deciding, just how different is that?
Well, it is different. Cases in front of a judge will go just fine if what you have is a kind of straight up arcane legal point, some important legal argument to make. But for a jury, that's where you want to have cases that really center on a particular story, that have some emotional impact, that appeal to human beings. Not that judges aren't human beings, but jurors are just different than judges with all of their technical legal learning.
So you can just wait and say, I want a trial by jury?
Well, yeah, they can just wait, but then you have another constitutional value that really gets impacted, and that, of course, is the right to have your trial and to have it in a non-delayed way.
So, David, how quickly are you entitled to have a trial?
Well, Pennsylvania state law says you've got to go to trial within 365 days of the charges being lodged against you, and sometimes pieces of that 365 days could be excluded if there's been, say, a defense request for a continuance or other things. The problem is the right to a speedy trial is very important to the potential for putting on a defense. It gets more and more difficult each day, because witnesses move away, witnesses may become reluctant or forget things, and sometimes a defendant is even incarcerated prior to trial, not able to make bail. The data shows pretty clearly that people who are locked up, for instance, prior to trial, have a much harder time putting on a defense.
Do we know if the 365-day period that you were talking about, do we know if the time that the courts were closed because of the pandemic were counted toward that or not?
Well, this is all new territory. You know, the court's orders, both the state Supreme Court and our local courts, have talked about what type of exclusions for time there have been and will be. But it's just inevitable that somebody is going to be convicted who has had their trial delayed, and those will become appeal issues. There is just no doubt about that.
So, right to a speedy trial, right to a trial by a jury of your peers. But what about the rights of the witnesses, the court personnel, and the jurors themselves to be healthy and safe.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, this is so important. I mean, you know, when we talk about our constitutional rights, there is a tendency, I think, to think in absolutes. I have a right to this, therefore I get this, and any impingement on this right is incorrect. Whereas in reality, rights are sometimes in conflict and we have to accommodate. For instance, we have a right to free speech, but it isn't unlimited. There are limits on the right to gather and petition and so forth. And here we have a textbook example. I mean, jurors get summoned to the courthouse. This is not their idea of a good time or something that they might want to do. And they have to sit in the courthouse in judgment. So we have to make sure that they can be safe. If there's no way for those people to be safe from the possibility of COVID-19, then we have to accommodate them too. There are many things in play here, and that's what makes this such a difficult moment.
David Harris is WESA's legal analyst and host of the Criminal and Justice Podcast. Thanks, David.
Great to be with you, Kevin.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. In August of 2005, 14-year-old Tiana Highsmith was at a church carnival in Brighton Heights. Shots rang out, and a bullet lodged in her spinal cord, paralyzing her from the waist down. Now, half a life later, Tiana Highsmith has died as a result of those injuries. Two representatives of the Pittsburgh Bureau of Police now hope to share her story in the hopes that someone with information might come forward. Public Information Officer Chris Tonieri met and wrote about Tiana some years ago, and Detective Joseph Belovitz is again working her case, now a homicide. The Confluence's Megan Harris joined them from a safe distance at police headquarters late last week.
Chris, I want to start with you. It's a rare enough thing to survive a shooting, but rarer still to keep on living with a piece of a bullet still inside your body. When you met Tiana a few years ago, how did you find her? What was she like?
So this would have been 2014. I was a reporter at the Pittsburgh Tribune Review, and I wanted to do a story on people who have bullets in their bodies. People who are shot survive, but the bullets remain in their bodies. I started by interviewing Dom Costa. I knew that he had a bullet at the base of his brain, and that was how it started from him. I went to former Pittsburgh police detective Jeff Smith, who was shot, I believe, in the Hill District in 2007. And then I just started asking for more people. Looked at old news articles. I did find the articles from 2005 about Tiana Highsmith, and I reached out to her, and she agreed to be interviewed.
How was she doing at the time? This was some years after the shooting at this point.
She was living in an apartment in Glen Hazel. And I remember photographer Andy Russell and I went to meet her. And the first thing that we remembered about her being in her apartment was there was just an incredible sense of optimism. And it was striking to be talking to her about this tragic turn of events in her life. And in fact, she said that she was fortunate to have gone through this experience, to be shot and paralyzed, because it helped her become the person that she was. She was a remarkable, incredible person. And that was you got that sense the moment you started talking to her.
Detective Belovitz, did you ever have occasion to meet Tiana?
Yes, I did, within a couple months of the shooting.
What was it about her and her case that maybe has stuck with you over the years?
Just her positivity and her resilience. Something so awful that happened to her, just the way she dealt with it, the way she faced it and overcame it was unbelievably impressive to me. As far as the case goes, it was to me just the prime example of just senseless violence. To see this young lady shot, paralyzed, her life totally changed. It was just awful. She had nothing to do with the dispute that led up to this, and she was just an truly innocent bystander.
And you're pursuing homicide charges now. Was anyone ever held accountable for the shooting back in 2005?
No.
Do you have any leads, anywhere to start?
We have some leads that we're working on. We can't publicly disclose them, but what we are looking for is more information from the public. We have a strong belief that there are people out there who have information on this, who know who did it and could come forward and really help us make this case.
What is that process like, investigating a case that's 15 years old where, you know, so much has changed, especially in a moment right now where most of the city is also enduring a pandemic?
It really involves just going back and talking to all the original witnesses, just going over the case from the beginning, kind of starting with a clean slate in a sense. As far as the pandemic, it hasn't really affected the case at this point. I mean, we've interviewed a couple people and it hasn't really been a problem. So we're hoping that continues to be the case.
Chris, before joining City Police, you were a reporter for the Pittsburgh Trib, and you reported in 2014 that when it comes to shooting victims, repair is often the primary goal, not necessarily the removal of a bullet. Why is that?
The doctor from UPMC that I spoke to explained that a bullet inside of a human body causes a lot of damage. In Tiana Highsmith's case, it was lodged against her spine, so going in to retrieve the bullet could have caused even more damage to her. In Detective Jeff Smith's case, they could have gone in to retrieve the bullet, but doing so would have required opening up his chest cavity. And so they weigh the pros and cons of it, and a lot of times the risk is too high to go in and get the bullet. So there are a lot of people who end up living their entire life with a bullet lodged inside of their body.
Detective, how unique is that situation when, you know, there was an initial incident, you know, some years ago, but because the person has now died because of those injuries, that new charges are filed?
It's not that unusual. I mean, we've had it happen already, I think, within the past year. We've had a couple cases where someone that was shot many years ago passed away, and the medical examiner's office has ruled that the death was, in fact, a result of the original incident, in that they would not have died had it not been for them being shot years ago.
When it comes to how you and your colleagues investigate, does it change anything for you for the way that you go about looking into these cases?
Not really. It's really just a homicide. We're not looking at it any differently because it happened years later. We treat it as if it's a fresh case.
Chris, when you spoke to Tiana back in 2014, she told you that she'd made peace with her reality. At the time, she had dreams of becoming a business owner, a wife, a mother. Do you know, was she able to achieve any of that before she passed?
I actually don't. My contact with her ended in 2014. There were a number of interviews. I remember when the story ran, I brought her some copies. And then really, it was in January when the medical examiner released the death notification that she had passed. At that point, I reached out to the former Trib photographer, Andy Russell, and informed him that she had passed. And we both were very sad to hear that.
Detective, have you had occasion to talk to her family? How are they doing?
We have. They're doing okay, considering. Obviously, they would like to see justice in this case, and that's really what we're aiming for here. They've had the fortunate opportunity to have those 15 years with her that they might not have had, had the bullet gone a couple inches or millimeters in another direction.
So as you look ahead, what are the odds then of getting justice for Tiana Highsmith?
It's really hard to say, and to be honest, we're going to work as hard as we can on it, but I think it really depends on the community. As I said, I think there are people out there who can help us, and it's just a matter of whether they want to.
Chris Tanieri and Detective Joe Belovitz are with the Pittsburgh Bureau of Police. Thank you both.
Thank you.
I'm Megan Harris.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at wesa.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Helen Wicker, Tom Hurley, Julia Zenkovich, Doug Schugertz, and Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.